This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 280 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce the two co-hosts. First, we'll start with Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Good evening from Chicago and 280 episodes. Do you realize in a mere 5 months we'll be 300? Hey, David, how old is Doctor Who? Isn't he 300 years old?
No, he's 1,200 plus.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog.
Hey, folks. Happy New Year's. Another 2014. I can't believe we've been doing this now for I don't know how long.
But five and a half years now.
5.5 years. So, yeah. Which means it's 4.5 for me. So, happy New Year, everyone. I hope 2014 turns out to be everything you wish for and another 50-plus podcasts to go.
But think of how many years we've been doing it in dog years.
We have to ask Simba that.
Yeah, what is he? Almost 40, he says.
Okay. Yeah. All right, well, we have two guests, both with some amazing backgrounds and interests. And first, we'll start off with Rod Rakic. He pioneered social media for aviation as the founder of MyTransponder.com. And recently, Rod's left his position as director of the digital innovation for Sears Holdings so he can concentrate full time on growing his new venture, Open Airplane. Rod started flight training when he was only 16. He holds an FAA commercial pilot certificate with an instrument rating. And Rod flies for business and pleasure, and he's also an active search and rescue pilot with the Civil Air Patrol, where he serves as a squadron operations officer with the rank of captain. So, Rod, it's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thanks so much for having me on. I've always been a fan of the podcast, and it's great to be here. I'm coming to you live from sunny Michigan, where it's currently just a few degrees above Kelvin. 0 degrees Kelvin.
Great. Well, whatever that means. I used to know what that meant, but it's been so long, I can't remember my Kelvin conversion. So
that's when the lowest temperature is minus 273 degrees Kelvin. Isn't that what it is?
And some are just a few degrees above absolute zero here.
Right. That's kind of what I meant anyway.
Celsius minus 273.
I thought we weren't going to talk about the weather.
We keep trying not to, but somehow it creeps in. Okay. Well, our other guest is Adam Fast. Now, Adam loves software coding and flying GA aircraft. He's been a software developer and a software consultant, but he combines that interest with aviation by things like geographically indexing the world's aviation museums, working on aircraft management software for his flying club, building a scheduling system to automatically create an itinerary for the world's largest air show. We all know what that is.
And I remember at that largest air show where I saw him put a Adam, do you remember you put a camera up on top of a stick? Or something about...
Oh, yeah, yeah. A camera on top of a tripod with a wireless shutter release and then a little LCD monitor at the base so that I could actually point said camera.
See, wow. And now drones have just taken over. Because now we just fly it. That's what we have to do this year at AirVenture, is fly a drone over the Sennheiser party or something, right?
Oh, that'll go over real well.
Adam, let's welcome Adam to the show. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Now, you two both share a common project, Open Airplane. How did you guys come together for this?
Well, you talked about social media. I mean, Open Airplane wouldn't exist if it wasn't for social media. Adam and I met as part of this gaggle of folks that were interested in producing social media that got together every year at AirVenture. And so, you know, when it was time to take this goofy idea and try to, you know, at least see if we could, you know, make it real. Adam stepped up to be the technical co-founder, and the rest, as they say, is history. Well, actually, one of our running jokes is that we're not quite sure if we're going to make history, but we're sure making a spectacle of ourselves.
And that's fun, even in and of itself, I guess. Well, we're going to talk about Open Airplane a lot coming up. First, though, we've got some aviation news to talk about. We also have David for your segment. What are we looking at this week?
Well, in the honor of taking a hit for the team, I was able to interview Lieutenant Commander David Tickle of the United States Navy Blue Angels, the 2013 and 2014 team. He's the number 5 solo pilot, and got to interview him at Philadelphia International Airport the weekend of the Army-Navy game because the Blues flew over, basically gave me an air show over my house, which is always nice. And bottom line, it was an interview outside in front of his jet in about 15-degree weather. So definitely a first for me with the Blue Angels.
Very good. All right. We'll look forward to that. We have an Across the Pond segment from Peter Johnson, and we also have some great listener mail coming up. So we'll look forward to that. But first, let's get started with the news from the last week. Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Yeah.
All right, let's start off by looking back at 2013 just a little bit. And we can use a USA Today article to sort of spark that conversation. This is titled, "The Year in Aviation, Major Changes Afoot." And they listed, I think, let's see, five items that they saw as major events or things happening in 2013. The American Airlines and U.S. Airways merger, the Asiana crash, the 15-hour rule, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner back flying again, and also PEDs and in-flight phone calls. So amongst those, maybe, Rob, we can start with you. Do you have some sort of favorites from that list or some others that you kind of think of when you look back at 2013?
Well, I kind of like, I tend to favor the automation ones just because it's a topic I'm interested in, but I still think back to something that Deb Herzman said. I think this was about midsummer, about how the NTSB was really tired of seeing the accident rate for general aviation airplanes plateau out. It hasn't gotten a whole lot worse, but it hasn't really gotten a whole lot better either. And they really wanted to start focusing on, you know, ways to actually drive the numbers, the number of fatalities and accidents down. And so when I see this list as a whole, this to me sounds like, hey, you know what? They're giving us some of what they promised, which is more than some other federal agencies involved with aviation that are in the same town that shall go nameless that I know of about.
How about Rod? Do you think of something particular when you think back on 2013 that sort of stands out?
I look back at the year, and one thing that I thought was a big story, but really had, you know, just a huge sort of potential for being even a worse story was the FAA deciding to slip a bill under the door of the EAA for ATC services at Oshkosh.
Ah, yes.
It seemed to me like it was an attempt to, at the camel's nose, sticking its nose under the tent, and we're just gonna put user fees where we can, and it doesn't matter if Congress votes to make that legal or not. We're just gonna decide that we can just stiff people with a bill. And you can't do anything about it. We've got you by the short and curlies, and we're just going to do it because we can. And it was just a horrible, way to try to, take the position of, being the FAA and turn it into a political, fight.
Yeah, sure. That was around $500,000, wasn't it, as I recall?
I don't remember even what the total bill was, but it was, you know, I'm from Chicago, and Chicago's a place where, you know, anything is possible if the envelope is thick enough. You know, vote early, vote often. And so this kind of felt natural, you know, in sort of, you know, government behavior, you know, bad government behavior. You know, I live six blocks from where it used to be Meeks Field. And, you know, the mayor of Chicago just destroyed the airport because he knew he could get away with it. He knew that there wasn't anyone there to stop him. And that's that same, you know, cold, you know, feeling in the pit of my stomach was what I felt when I, you know, I read the stories about what the FAA did to Oshkosh.
And we don't really have any idea what's going to happen in 2014 in that regard, do we?
Well, there is a big pending lawsuit. You know, I've actually been lucky enough to chat with some of the counsel that has, you know, shot the broadside back at, you know, the government in terms of taking them to court over this. You know, the EAA's got some really smart people working on this, and it's unfortunately going to get worked out in the courts. I don't think that there's going to be any kind of collaboration on this. I think that EAA's taking the FAA to court, and they're going to work it out there, and the FAA is going to be told what they can and can't do.
How about David or Adam? Any other things come to mind?
Well, for me, I guess the big deal was sequester from a military. Well, and this affected EAA, is what Rod was talking about. But 2013 will be the year without demonstration teams. The hiding or the shutdown of the Thunderbirds, the Blue Angels, the Golden Knights, any flyovers, and the amazing things that happened with people pulling together to make those happen, like the RV team flyover over Kansas City late last year. It's nice that they'll be back in 2014, plus all of the operations. So many squadrons lost valuable flying time and air shows. And I guess sequester was a huge deal as far as the military aviation world and the many tentacles that it reached out and touched.
Adam, anything that comes to your mind?
I think pretty much everything that's been said already. It's been interesting to watch the 787 ordeal and just kind of see where exactly that's going to leave. What are they going to have to do engineering-wise?
It's been entertaining, certainly.
It's been really weird. You know, you would expect that engineering tolerances would have been where we probably wouldn't see this, but we have.
And one thing that, you know, talking about the Dreamliner, the 787, one thing that had been on people's minds, I think, and on the operators' minds, is about maintenance of the airframe and dealing with composite materials instead of the, you know, more classic aluminum. And we kind of saw the first test of that in a way with the Ethiopian fire and Boeing's method for effecting a repair, which I guess was accomplished, but we don't have a lot of details. I think Boeing is not saying a lot about the specific details of that repair, but it seems like they did accomplish that. So that was good news for Boeing, good news for all composite airliners. Well, what about looking ahead a little bit into 2014? Anybody have any thoughts on what might be the kind of the big issues, the big stories this coming year?
UAVs.
Yeah, we saw the FAA announced the six sites for the UAS, Unmanned Aerial System, test centers. So, David, this is going to be, well, this is something that we'll be talking about at the UAV Digest this week, later this week in our 20th episode. But just briefly, this is kind of a significant milestone in the commercialization of UAVs and them entering into the airspace, isn't it?
It is. And the six choices were quite surprising. Some of the people who you thought were going to get it, like Ohio, didn't. It was Alaska, Griffiths Airport in New York, upstate New York, Texas A&M, Virginia Tech, University of North Dakota, one out there for Martin, Nevada. This is the first step down the roadmap that we've talked about on the other show. We'll be watching it closely. And it, the test center for all of our pilot listeners to pay attention to is Griffiths, New York, because that's the one, the reason why it's there is they want to actively integrate drones into congested Northeast airspace. So that's its primary mission. So that'll be the sense and avoid one for everyone to watch as far as the pilot community is concerned.
All right. Other thing,
I don't think, oh, go ahead, Max.
No, no, go ahead, Rob.
I was going to say, the one thing I don't think they've done yet is they really haven't talked about the nuts and bolts of how that's all going to work. And one thing I'm particularly interested in, and I think all the sites are going to face this, but more so maybe the one in New York, is that I want to see how they're going to share the data that they gather. You know, how are they going to how are they going to track the data, say, of the number of close calls between drones or any close calls between drones, UASs, UAVs, whatever we call them. I don't know all the names. You guys do. But I really want to know that they're doing more than just trying to figure out how to fly these things in airspace. But I want to know that they're gathering data that the rest of us can use to help this work, as opposed to just, you know, FAA saying, well, we did all the research for you. Here's the answer. And you guys just go along with it because it's all fine and it's fine.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, in one way of looking at it is the hard part really starts now.
That's right. That's exact. Thank you. That's a good point.
All right. Other items. Let's see. I think the COMAC C919 is supposed to make its first flight in 2014. We'll see if that happens. They still have some certification problems with the FAA not yet endorsing the Chinese certification process. So that's kind of hung up with the ARJ-21 regional jet. The FAA is not recognizing the certification competence of the CAAC, the Civil Aviation Administration of China. And that kind of spills over into the C919. So we'll see what happens there. That may be a big issue in 2014. Let's see. What else? There's some chatter about maybe the launch of an A330neo. The A330 maybe could use some engine upgrades, possibly, to compete more effectively against the 787 Dreamliner. So there's some chatter about that maybe happening, maybe not. That could be something that would be a big story in 2014. David, anything military coming down the road that we see? I guess we've got the F-35 kind of continuing to be developed as it's in production.
Yeah, that one. China, I guess the Pacific Rim area where we're slowly escalating between China and Japan and South Korea and North Korea and the United States, the interplay between aviation and, of course, drones. But more importantly, we have air shows again this year. So there will be open houses throughout the country where people can actually see their hardware they're paying for, unlike last year. So I'm looking for, I've already booked Pensacola and I got a field trip to McGuire. So, and believe it or not, the Thunderbirds are performing at Air Venture this year.
Hooray. All right. Well, maybe we can ask our listeners, too, if you have any big thoughts or if you have any thoughts as to what might be some big stories for 2014, pass them along, send them in to us. The geeks at airplanegeeks.com. We'd love to get your ideas for what's going to be big in 2014. And then maybe at the end of the year, 12 months from now, we can look back at our what we thought were going to be the big stories and see if they were or not and what we missed. All right, well, let's move on. You know, another thing that we've seen that is seems to be growing and it might be more of an issue in 2014 is fees. And we have an article from Business Week. Airlines say Happy New Year with new fees. Now, this came in from listener Cal. He had I just got to read what he said because I think it's pretty entertaining. He says, I love the fact that we get charged so much on ancillary revenue. Thank God for O'Leary and Ryan for teaching the American airline industry a lesson in how to achieve profitability. I just long for the day where the same bathroom on board has a credit card swiper. We can call it the waste disposal fee, because the airline will decide that people just find it socially embarrassing to have to pee in the aisles, so they'll pony up. So the article points out some increases in fees. Virgin Atlantic has got a 25-pound fee now for advanced seating. United has doubled the fee for oversized bags and for three or more checked bags. And Spirit Airlines has increased their bag fees as well. But, you know, the article points out this is big money, that the U.S. airlines collected $879 million in baggage fees and $735 million in ticket change fees. And that's just in the third quarter of 2013. You know, years ago, I remember saying the fees are the crack cocaine of the airlines. Once you go down that path, boy, you don't go back.
But isn't it funny what Cal said about the relationship between O'Leary and how he really did start that nickel and diming thing with people, and we all laughed at that 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And isn't it funny how when you look at it now, the airlines are making money because they're nickel and diming people, just like O'Leary was.
Exactly.
It's crazy. It's too bad we don't have Dan here for this kind of comment. But anyway.
Well, I think the airlines would not be profitable to any significant extent if it weren't for these fees. I mean, this has kind of saved the airlines. I mean, do you agree with that? Do you think fees are a good thing because of that?
You know, I just wish, this is just me, rather than a $250 round trip fare that ends up costing me $319 with all the fees, just tell me the damn thing's $319. And tell me it includes everything. I'd like that better, but that's just me.
That's me also, but I don't think that's most people, which is so bizarre. People focus on the, you know, what's the airfare? What's the base airfare? Make a decision based on that, and then, you know, catch all these extra fees along the way, and it doesn't...
Well, but you know, if these airlines hadn't spent so much time trying to bamboozle everybody and hide the fees in various places so that people became suspicious of them, I wonder if we'd still have ended up in the same place. I don't
know. Yeah.
But, Rob, it's a marketplace problem.
Well, that's true.
Where's the marketplace for airline tickets, right? It's not on the, you know, it's typically not on the airline site. Where are they competing against each other? They're competing in that big grid we all look at when we go online at some aggregator site and look and see, you know, what time do I want to depart and what time am I going to get there and how many stops are there going to be and what the price is. And if the price, which is what everyone's competing on, means that you'll buy the ticket or not, and you can hide the fees downstream, right, from where that competition really happens. And that marketplace is on the travel aggregator sites, the Hipmunks and the Kayaks and, you know, Orbitz and, you know, all that stuff, right? That's where the competition is. That's where the marketplace is. And they're simply reacting to, you know, that pressure to win the sale, sell the ticket, and try to make it profitable later. I wouldn't blame the airlines as much as I'd blame the folks we're buying the ticket through.
Rod, I think you're absolutely right on that. I find it hard to, even though I'm sometimes critical, I find it hard to fault the airlines for doing this because, I mean, if it was my company, that's exactly what I would be doing.
No, and I agree with you, and that was my point about O'Leary, is that I think O'Leary probably got to some of these people at American, United, Delta, Continental, whatever, saying, do you guys realize there's a reason you're not making any money?
Right.
You know, you're leaving money on the table. And it seems as if some of them really started to listen. My only point was I just wish there were a common, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't want to say a common format because that makes it sound like I'm looking for regulation and I'm not. But I just wish there was a common way to define the final price. And then that, you know what? Everybody just gets a seat that they want. You know, it's pre-assigned or you have your whatever, and nobody pays to carry their bags anymore, or everybody pays to carry some of the bag, and it's just one flat price. But, you know, again, so when you talk about the aggregators, Rod, I realize what they're doing, but they're doing it to, well, they're certainly not doing it to make our lives easier, because it's a nightmare sometimes to try to book an airline ticket and find out that you didn't even understand what you were buying because of the way it's worded. And I don't know, but that's just me. Maybe I'm getting old.
Well, those marketplaces are not incentivized to create, you know, to give you good information. They're incentivized, you know, if you go to Kayak and you see the ticket for $250, and then you go over to Hipmunk, and for some reason the way Hipmunk sort of includes a tax or a fee or something like that, it's $259. Your typical consumer is going to go back to the first site, and I'm just using this as examples, but they'll go back to the first site and buy the cheaper ticket. Now, you know, that means that even the marketplaces are, you know, screwed up in the way they're incentivized, because, you know, they're not going to make any money unless they buy, you know, the consumer buys the ticket through them. And the only, you know, driver of that typically is not a value proposition of which site gives you the best information. It's, you know, incentivized based on which site can give you the cheapest price.
That's you're right there. And most people don't even know it. If you were to say the best information to 20 people, they'd all give you a different definition of what they think the best information to make the decision is. I don't think most of them even know.
So my theory on this is that this is here to stay. And the only real danger is if the airlines get carried away with this and get too greedy and just really, you know, boost fees, maybe a little at a time, but to the point where they're really oppressive. And then there could be a customer or consumer backlog that could backfire. But as long as the airlines don't get too greedy, I think this is the new reality, and it's going to stay that way for quite a while.
Oh, I think it's already too late. I think that's already started. I think you're already starting to see the shift. You're starting to see innovators like Surf Air, who are, you know, building out, you know, sort of all you can eat air travel along short defined routes. You know, you're starting to see already sort of the top end going away from commercial travel, and they're going to the charter business, right? Mm-hmm. The charter business is going gangbusters. The charter business is growing, and the best friend to that growth in the Part 135 world is the fact that, you know, airline travels, you know, essentially become broken and is getting more and more broken. So the folks who can afford to avoid it have already left. And now other people are trying to find other ways to avoid having to deal with it. And like I said, I really enjoy watching Surf Air, you know, continue to be successful with their, you know, whole new model for how to, you know, get people, you know, from LA to San Francisco. And I hope to see more of that. Hmm.
All right. Well, let's take a look at our last news item, which is from Business Wire. We see Textron to acquire Beechcraft. Textron plans to purchase all of the outstanding equity shares in Beech Holdings, which is the parent of Beechcraft Corporation, which itself just emerged from bankruptcy only in February 2013. So the price? About $1.4 billion in cash. The press reports say Textron's going to fund this from their available cash and also new debt. So just to kind of set the stage, Textron is basically what, guys? Cessna, Bell Helicopter, Lycoming, and a bunch of others.
And Beechcraft now.
Beech Holdings is Hawker Bizjets, King Air, Baron, Bonanza, also the T-6 trainer, and that AT-6 light attack military aircraft. So it's not a done deal. It requires government approval. And that's going to take a little bit of time, I guess. But what do you guys think? Good idea all around, probably?
I think Beechcraft would have probably disappeared.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shame. I mean, we won't see the Hawker jets come back. I don't think the Hawker 800, 900 series are coming back, or the Hawker 4000, or I don't even know about the Premiers or any of that. But my guess is, with all the ups and downs that Hawker Beechcraft has had over the last couple of years, this deal would not have come together if the people at Textron, who had obviously a whole lot of cash, hadn't said, you know what, we'll offer you guys a really good price for your company if you sell it to us. Because I think if the Beechcraft people thought they could really make a go of it on their own, they'd have said, hey, we don't need you. We're fine. We're out of bankruptcy. We're fine. We've cut our product line down somewhat, but got rid of the unprofitable side. Except I don't think that's what it was. I think they said, you know, probably not such a bad idea. Except I still can't imagine calling a Cessna King Air. No, I guess it wouldn't be that. It would be a, at worst, a Textron King Air. But
well, do you think they'll keep the brand identity?
They'll keep the name, I'm sure. Yeah. It'll be like Textron and Beechcraft is Textron.
Well, yeah, and so is Bell.
That's right.
I mean, they're all branded Cessna, a Textron company, Bell, a Textron company, Beechcraft, a Textron company. I mean, they're still building King Airs.
That's right, except all the people on social media were calling them Cessna King Airs and things, but they were just making fun of it, I think.
Well, I still haven't forgiven the government for making it the T6 Texan 2. But that's neither here nor there. And that line is still open, and there's a lot of overseas sales. So I think Textron's getting a good deal.
I think it's interesting what with Textron just announcing out of the blue their fighter jet so recently and now acquiring Beechcraft with the attack version of the Texan 2 and the Texan 2 itself. Kind of makes you wonder if they're not trying to expand significantly internationally in the military sector, maybe try to buy up everything they could. I'm sure they're going to keep the King Air because I think at Oshkosh they signed something over $1 billion of sales just on the King Air.
Yeah, that was that 105 King Air 350i order, I think, wasn't it, to Wheels Up?
Yeah.
Yeah, Adam, that's interesting, though, that about you know, where they may go as a combined company, you know, in future directions. I mean, it certainly puts Textron in a pretty strong position in the general aviation market.
Well, think of what's built here anymore. I mean, you know, let's see, the Beechcraft and the Cessnas are still going to be built here. Cirrus is hopefully still going to be built here. Piper's built here. What's left?
Well, I think of it as two things. One is all the Hawker owners now know that they're not going to get abandoned, and you know, they'll have some kind of you know, path to maintaining their aircraft, and you know, and then the second thing is it fills a gap in the Cessna product line, because the only turboprop Cessna was making was a single, was the Caravan, and you know, God bless it, but you know, there's, you know, missions that you need a twin engine airplane, and you know, Cessna hasn't made twins for, you know, that have props on the front for quite a long time, and so you know, that's where the, you know, the King Air continues to dominate that segment of the market. Now they've, you know, they've buttoned that up nicely.
Yeah. Oh, I think it was a good move. That's why I think they saw a deal and they said, hey man, this fits. It's like the way Southwest bought AirTran, and just said, fits really nicely in there.
And it stays under U.S. ownership.
Yeah. Well, for now.
For now. Okay.
They sell it to the Chinese. I don't know.
I don't think Textron's going to the Chinese anytime soon.
No. No.
They're way too much. They're way too integral into the defense industry.
Yeah. Beechcraft may have gone, but Textron won't.
Well, if you want to talk about the Chinese, you know, look at what they did just a few weeks ago in sort of liberalizing the requirements for getting a pilot's license.
Yeah.
Right? Which sort of sets the foundation for them to eventually liberalize the airspace. And now once you've got the ability to, you know, fly legally, you know, they're doing, you know, the folks in China that are flying business jets today, they just pay the you know, the fine. They're not doing it legally, but they do it all the time. And that's what everyone is really prepping for. You know, going back to that question about what comes next in 2014, well, I think, you know, like the city of Wichita just put an office, you know, created, you know, the China office. You know, everyone is just lining up at the start line, waiting for the the starter pistol to go off for the, you know, this massive new market in selling general aviation services, equipment, training, you know, everything, you know, to build out this new market. It's like where telecom was 20 years ago when China just kind of went from a really horrible landline, you know, copper wire based telecommunications infrastructure. And instead of building that all out, they went right to wireless because that's what was, you know, sort of state of the art at the time. And so they skipped the whole, you know, wireline technology. One reason why was because in China, you'd have people actually tear down the wires and sell the copper. So, you know, wiring that country wasn't a really great idea. But they went right to this much more modern sort of wireless technology. Well, I see the same kind of parallel to China building a GA market that didn't exist before, especially when you see, you know, this massive, you know, I guess you just bubble in the new rich. They can't buy enough sports cars, bling, and the folks I've talked to that are spending time in China, you can't walk by a magazine rack that doesn't show good-looking people standing in front of sleek jet aircraft, you know, private aircraft that with fancy supercars parked in front of them. It's just this new aspiration, and it's driving a whole new market. And everyone's just waiting for the starter pistol to go off.
Yeah, Rod, that could be the big story for the next 5 years or so. You know, and it's accelerating pretty quickly because I remember when I used to travel to Beijing fairly frequently about, I don't know, 10 years ago, let's say. If you look at the traffic in the streets of Beijing, it was mostly bicycles with smaller but pretty much equal numbers of automobiles and horses, believe it or not. And of course, you go to Beijing now, and it's, you know, it's all automobiles, and we're beyond just the inexpensive kind. And as you mentioned, Rod, we're, you know, into the luxury cars and that sort of thing. So yeah, this could be the big aviation story going forward.
Hey, Rod.
Yes, David.
Have you figured out what open airplane is in Chinese yet?
not just yet. Just yet.
Isn't it just a little glyph of a guy with a headset and sunglasses?
Well, let's talk about open airplane. Rod, can you tell our listeners what problem does it solve?
Open airplane was designed to solve the problem that when I leave my home base as a private pilot, in most cases, my pilot certificate essentially becomes useless. It gets turned off. You know, you might spend over $10,000 getting a private pilot certificate. You might spend 6 months, a year, you know, a significant amount of investment in time and money to have that little piece of plastic in your back pocket. But then it becomes useless when you leave your home base once you fly yourself somewhere in your own airplane. And that just was something that I felt really strongly was holding back, you know, the growth of general aviation across the industry, because you had all this time and money and, you know, and friction in the marketplace, really, you know, leaving the private aviation segment of general aviation. You know, not the, again, we talked about earlier, you know, the charter side's doing great, the training side's doing fine, but the private aviation economy, you know, depends on it being a marketplace, and that marketplace is broken.
And so how does this work?
Open Airplane set out with the idea that we could make renting an airplane as easy as renting a car. We created a universal pilot checkout, a standardization and evaluation program, something that you find if you fly for the military, you fly for a charter company or air carrier. They all have STAN eval, but private Part 91 flying really didn't have that. And really what that left the insurance industry with was this requirement that you would have to do a checkout with someone who owned the airplane before they would be able to rent that airplane to you, which means that, you know, pilots were not flying enough. They weren't flying because you'd have to spend hundreds of dollars and half a day to sort of turn your pilot's license back on if you were traveling somewhere, you know, for business or pleasure. And we did a survey back in 2011 where we asked pilots, would you fly more if it was a simpler service? 94% of the pilots said that they would use a service like this.
Wow.
51% of the time, the reason pilots don't fly away from home is the complicated checkout. 28% of the time, it was because it was just hard to find an airplane. You know, just finding an airplane to rent used to be a 45-minute process of Google searches, phone calls, voicemails, and emails. And we've turned that really, you know, 45 minutes of hassle into 45 seconds.
And so who are the players in open airplane? I mean, you've got the pilots, obviously, and you've got, what, the aircraft owners? Who are they?
So we came up with this term of operator. We wanted to have something to refer to the second side of the marketplace. Open airplane really is a two-sided marketplace. The first side, like you said, are the pilots. Pilots that want to fly themselves, rent an airplane, you know, whether to, for a local hop or to take a trip somewhere, and they want to fly themselves. They don't want to necessarily hire a professional crew. We're not talking about air taxi 135 operations. We're definitely talking about Part 91. So we've got one group of people, one side of the marketplace being pilots. The other side of the marketplace is actually pretty broad. Right now, it's flight schools that have aircraft that are not flying all the time, that may be parked for too long and aren't getting the utilization that they need to be profitable. But it also can be flying clubs. Actually, Rob's Flying Club here in Chicago is going to be one of the first flying clubs who's stood up to join the open airplane network, and eventually even potentially individual aircraft owners who want to see more utilization of the aircraft. So we built open airplane to handle two sides of the marketplace. One is the pilots, and this other one is the operators, anyone who's operating an aircraft that's available for rent. So we don't refer to them as just flight schools. We don't just refer to them as FBOs. We just use this more broader term of operator. So we've got pilots on one side and operators on the other.
So, Adam, what is your role in this? I mean, do you just take these grand ideas from Rod and try to figure out some way to code them up into a system? How are you approaching it?
I'd say it's a lot more collaborative than that. There was certainly a case where he had a lot of ideas, but my approach has definitely been to think through it from my experience in aviation and in leadership in a flying club and just being exposed and immersing myself to try to understand every aspect of all this stuff to build the right business rules and sort of bring up things that maybe he hadn't thought of or what widen the use case or narrow the use case where it's effective, just so that we have the best system we can and we think as far in the future as we can.
And so all this takes place at the Open Airplane website for people who are members. Is that what you call it? Would call them as members?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, members works, pilots works. I think we normally just refer to them as pilots.
And so maybe you guys can kind of walk us through. Say I'm a pilot and I know I'm going to be in some other state next month for some reason and I'd like to rent an airplane. What's the process that I would go through?
So a pilot joins Open Airplane by creating a profile on openairplane.com. You can go to openairplane.com on a smartphone. You can do it on a tablet. Most of us are flying with tablets in the cockpit today, or on a desktop machine. It's all the same. There's no download. You don't have to download any software from the App Store or anything like that. Just go to openairplane.com. You create this profile. All that information that normally you would have to fill out this job, this huge amount of information that you would normally have to do over and over and over again anytime you wanted to fly at different places, we simply created an online form for you to fill out, and you only have to fill out that form once. And that way, that information about your experience, your certificates, your endorsements, your currencies, all travel with you every time you want to use the system to book a rental.
I think more generically than that, we should make sure to also get the point that you don't have to show up and sign up and enter all of your certificate info and all of your currency and all that stuff if you're just thinking hey, I'm traveling here and I really want to get an airplane. If you just, there's a button right next to the join button that says search the network, and also Ace, who's our mascot, at the top left-hand corner of the page. If you click that without any sort of sign up or hassle, you can go ahead and throw in an airport code or search nearby and just see if there's even an airplane available without needing to create anything.
That's a great point. So once you found an airplane that you'd like to rent, you make a request to rent that airplane using Open Airplane. Now, before you can rent it just as pilot command, you would have to do a checkout. And so you would find a operator that's in our network. And usually the way pilots are using this is they'll get checked out at an operator near their home base when it's convenient. So you're not burning vacation time or real, you know, critical time while you're on a business trip to go fly a checkout. You fly this universal pilot checkout, and really it does three things for you. It resets the clock on your flight review. It earns the pilot up to a 10% discount on their renter's insurance. And it earns them access to the same make model aircraft for the next 12 months. So one thing that was frustrating pilots about renting away from your home base is there would often be these currency requirements where you get checked out at an operator near where you're having your vacation. But if you came back 6 months later, you couldn't rent again because that currency, which may be like 90 days or something like that, would expire. So we've solved a lot of the friction points in renting airplanes so that pilots can get more value out of the pilot certificate in their back pocket.
And so what kind of volumes have you seen so far? How many pilots have signed up and how many aircraft are available and have been rented? Can you give us some idea of some of those statistics?
Well, broadly, we started Open Airplane in June with six cities around the U.S. when we launched the beta, and we're still in beta. We launched with six cities. We're now live in 33 cities around the United States. We even have two Skyhawks as far north as Palmer, Alaska. We're very proud of that. We've got 118 aircraft in the network as of today. That number keeps changing, and it keeps going north as we continue to add new operators, and we're adding operators pretty regularly now as this continues to grow. And we've had over 5,100 pilots sign up to fly with us. So we have really sort of been, in the first 6 months of the business, really concentrating on growing that network of operators and proving that this idea, which started just by trying to solve the problem and try to make flying more valuable for all of us, improving that idea. And that's what we've been doing in this first 6 months in business.
Hmm. So, Rob, is this something that excites you as a pilot?
No.
I should have known better.
No, seriously. I remember when Rod and I were talking about this at a local pizza shop up here in Evanston a couple of years ago, and I thought, I don't know what he expected, but I said, this is a pretty cool idea. I said, I didn't know if you'd get it past the insurance companies. I think I said something like, well, you get it past the insurance companies and it might work. I think people would love to do that, because I don't think there's any of us that fly that have a travel store that don't have one of these travel checkout nightmare stories. And I mean, I've got a couple of them over the years, and it just the problem with checkouts is not just what Rod mentioned about a particular operator and Adam too, but that it kind of sets up a thought process that, you know what, when I go somewhere, I'm not even going to bother. I don't care. Yeah, I know my last miserable experience was down in Florida, but you know, I'm going to Texas or I'm going to California or I'm going to Nevada. I'm not even going to bother because I know where it's going to end up and I don't care and it's too much work. And so I just won't fly while I'm there. And I think this is going to make people say, wait a minute, maybe I've been a little hasty. And that's at least that's what I hope. I do think if you guys can, you know, tell enough people and get people, you know, flying and get people talking about their experiences and kind of get rid of some of that bad press that checking out in an airplane out of, you know, away from home has, I think it could be a really great thing. I really do. So I really obviously hope it works, because I think I told Rod he has to buy me pizza again in a month or something.
Deal. Totally. Yeah.
Okay.
I think you're right. I think that people have had a lot of questions about this. You know, one thing that pilots, we say, well, we're flying this universal pilot checkout. You have to demonstrate that you're flying to the PTS. And that can be a little anxiety generating for some pilots. But, you know, what we're seeing in the first 6 months of operation is that 80% of the pilots who show up to do a universal pilot checkout pass. They demonstrate a satisfactory flight check, and you know, they're ready to rent on the first try. So that makes us feel like we're hitting a sweet spot. That means that, of course, 20% of the pilots are maybe not up to the standard on some component of the checkout. We're identifying pilots who are probably showing up thinking that they're proficient in everything they need to be proficient in. And when we, well, the nice thing, the thing that's been a pleasant surprise is that almost always when a pilot doesn't fly to the standard, they end up going back and buying more training, getting more proficient, getting back up to the standard, polishing up the things that are giving them trouble, and you know, moving forward and becoming renters in the system. And of course, now they're safer pilots for it. So we think we're now incentivizing pilots to fly their best and stay sharp. Like my friend Jason Miller, you know, on his podcast likes to say about, you know, helping pilots fly their best. We're very much inspired by that same kind of ideal. We want to be an incentive for pilots to fly more, to get more utilization out of their pilot certificate. And be, you know, ultimately safer pilots for it.
Yeah, it sounds great. Now, across those 33 operators that are in the network currently, what kinds of airplanes are we typically looking at?
Open Airplane was endorsed by Cessna very early on. We became an endorsed partner for Cessna Aircraft, essentially, especially with their Cessna Pilot Center network. Providing a standardization evaluation component that really didn't exist before. And so as we started to grow the network, we were very Cessna-centric. The number one most plentiful airframe in the fleet right now is steam gauge-equipped Cessna 172 Skyhawks. Right behind that are glass cockpit-equipped 172 Skyhawks. But then everything from 162 Skycatchers to the 400, the Corvettes, are in the rental network. But as we've been growing in the last few months, we're adding a lot more mixed fleets. So we've got Pipers and Diamonds. We just added our first Cirrus SR-22 G3 Turbo to the network down in Scottsdale at Sawyer Aviation, as well as some LSAs in addition to the Skycatcher. We've got some Remoses in the network, and we're going to be growing that as we continue to grow the network. So what can you expect when you log on to Open Airplane? You'd expect to see what you typically find across the country in the flight training ecosystem. And of course, that's very 172 centric. So that's kind of the lingua franca of the network today.
Adam, is the system online pretty much completed, or are you still developing aspects to it, or are you just sort of tweaking it now?
Software projects are never over.
I know. Yeah.
There are hundreds, if not thousands, of little touches that would be amazing to have done. So it is there, and it works, and it does what we need, and we're adding things sort of as time allows and as operationally it becomes necessary.
Are the pilots and the operators giving you feedback?
Yeah, we're getting feedback, both positive and negative, which is good, and
sure.
dealing with the negative as expediently as we can.
We actually really look for and try to find where the negative feedback is, as well as where the pilot. It's really easy for people to get excited about the idea, But if they don't tell us what's broken, we can't fix it. So we're constantly sort of pushing for that negative feedback because it really makes a difference in the experience that we can deliver. One example of the positive feedback was a couple weeks ago, right before the holiday, we had a bunch of pilots all sort of chime in and say they'd really like to see gift certificates. And so we kind of leaned in and right in a week before Christmas, launched a new feature to allow someone that isn't on Open Airplane, that doesn't have a profile on Open Airplane. So let's say it's a loved one or a colleague or a friend who wants to buy you a gift certificate so you can fly with Open Airplane and not just fly at one airport, but fly at any of the 33 operators. And we launched that, feature about a week and a half after, folks kind of ganged up on us.
Yeah, Rob, you should point that out to your wife.
Yes, and I did like that. And, actually, the gift certificate's an interesting concept. And I'm curious, what's been the most sort of popular couple, wow, this is so cool, and then fill in the blank that you guys seem to have heard from people these days?
People really
appreciate. You guys are like superstars or anything like that.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but like I said, we're making a spectacle of ourselves. I would say that one feature of the Open Airplane platform that people really appreciate is the local procedure briefing. There's this gap of, let's call it tribal knowledge, between what's published on the chart and what's available in the AFD and what like all the local folks already know, right? The folks, I'll use Pulwalkie as an example. You start taxiing your aircraft, even though it's clearly the non-movement area. If you start taxiing that airplane over there, on the other side of the field, the tower is going to yell at you just because that's how it's done there. And there's no way to know that. And there's tons of little bits and pieces of tribal knowledge that, if you're based at an airport, you know about, you get to know, and makes life just a little bit smoother. And we realized that one thing we wanted to do is be able to help pilots fly with the confidence of a local when they rent airplanes through our system. So one, we created this thing called the local procedure briefing, which is part of the platform that details a lot of that stuff that normally they would try to jam into your head if you were doing a local checkout. But now you can actually review it on your iPad while you're waiting for your commercial flight to whisk you to your destination. And it's in text and it's graphics and you can review it at your own speed and it's available. We thought it was so important that the local procedure briefings are actually available to anyone who searches the app before they even create a profile. They're available to Google searches, et cetera, because we just felt like that was such valuable information that we wanted to get out there and share with the community. And that information gets updated by the operator on a regular basis.
So then let me play devil's advocate for just a second and be the insurance guy. And I say, well, Rod, Adam, that's great, but how do I know that, Frank actually looked at that before he left? How do you track that?
The great thing about software and having a software developer who's actually in the business of flying airplanes. So our, these little touches that Adam was talking about, for instance, our system actually tracks that a pilot has seen the local procedure briefing before their rental shows up. So those are those kinds of things. And, quite honestly, it's still the pilot's responsibility as pilot in command. That doesn't change. The relationship between the insurance company and the operator doesn't change because Open Airplane is there. We're just making it easier than it ever was before.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point.
All right. Well, Rod, before we move on, can we just ask, how does the there must be fees, or how does the money change hands here? How does that work?
The business model question. I've always joked that the business model for Open Airplane was simple enough that even us pilots could understand it. We created it in a way that we felt would incentivize the right things. So Open Airplane is free for pilots to join. It is free for operators to join the network, list their aircraft, and participate in our Stan Eval program. We take a percentage of the rental revenue that we enable. So only when someone uses Open Airplane to do something they couldn't otherwise do, they couldn't go and, you know, get a checkout that gets them a discount like this on their insurance, or they go and they rent an airplane without the hassle and the expense of a local checkout before they rent, is we're there collecting a small percentage. We turned what could have been kind of a hassle, which is collecting the money, into a net positive. So most of the time when you rent an airplane, you put the airplane to bed and you walk in, you hand in the keys and the clipboard, and then you watch the poor, you know, 24-year-old behind the counter fight with the credit card machine, right? Hmm. Well, now when you rent with Open Airplane, you actually use the credit card that you already got on file with us. So for all the same reasons, like, you know, your insurance information and your medical and your 90-day currency and all that is in your Open Airplane profile. When you when you're done renting the airplane, you simply input the Hobbs and Tack time into the app. We calculate the bill. You drop off the keys of the clipboard at the front desk, and you walk out the door. We've made it simpler. And by the way, it's a great way to pay your bill.
All right. Well, tell our listeners where they can find Open Airplane and some of the other information about the process and how it works.
Sure. So Open Airplane, www.openairplane.com. There you can search the network. You can create a profile. We've got all kinds of information down on the footer of every page, so you can look at the participation agreement. You can get information on how the whole system works. We have a whole online pilot guide that's actually available at pilots.openairplane.com. You can go right to the pilot guide, and it's kind of walks you through the whole process, as well as you know, places like Facebook, you know, facebook.com/openairplane. You can find us on Twitter. And so we're active. We use those surfaces not only a way to, you know, sort of share the news of what we're up to and what progress we're making, but also it's a great way to actually, you know, ask us questions, get a hold of us, and make sure that you're having a great experience.
All right, good. And we'll put links to all those in the show notes, of course. And Rod and Adam, tell our listeners where they can find you personally online.
I'm pretty easy to find online. You can find me at Rod Rakic, RodRakic, on Twitter. It's the easiest way to connect with me. I'm also on all the usual places like Facebook and LinkedIn.
All right. And how about you, Adam?
Yeah, same deal for me. I'm Adam Can Fly, AdamCinFly, on Twitter and then Facebook as well. And, well, yeah, LinkedIn too.
All right. Brilliant idea. Sounds like it's really well executed.
Can I just add one comment, though?
Oh, I'm sure,
really,
Rob. Go ahead.
Important. I mean, I don't think I shared this with Adam ages ago, but I did with Rod, that I had a very easy way to sort of keep the culture of Chicago going as they sort of got this business up and running. And rather than use credit cards, I thought they should just have people deposit the bill in cash in a brown bag and then leave it behind a can in the back end of the hangar, and then someone would pick it up, and that would be a really cool way to kind of give it a sort of a Chicago flavor. And those guys didn't like that idea. Thank God.
I can't imagine why, Rob.
Good luck, guys. I think it's a great idea. I'm really glad you were here tonight.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. I think our listeners will find this very fascinating. And, you know, it's great to have something that, you know, I mean, it works for everybody. It you know, drives up the utilization of aircraft. It helps, as you've mentioned, it helps maintain pilot proficiency. And it just gets people flying more, which is always good.
We should have these guys back next December 30th and see how the fortunes have changed.
Yeah, or we can get an update at Oshkosh.
Well, that's true, but maybe by then Rod will have the orange Cirrus he always told me he wanted.
I see.
It's kind of an inside joke. Okay.
That's okay. Anytime, guys. Thanks for having us. Really appreciate being able to talk to your listeners.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I agree as well.
Okay, now it's time for David Vanderhoof. David, you want to set this up?
Yeah, actually this year, the Blue Angels were the Navy component for the flyover for the United States Navy Army-Navy game, which 90% of the time occurs right down the road at Lincoln Financial Field here in Philadelphia, where the neutral ground between the two academies. This year, we had a beautiful sunny day on Friday. We had basically a snowstorm for the football game. Surprisingly, the Navy brought in the Blue Angels, the whole component, including Fat Albert, and the Army brought in six Apaches, two UH-60Ds, and a UH-72 Lakota. And surprisingly, they all flew over the respective teams at the show. On Friday, I abruptly left my Christmas party and from my office and drove frantically down to the airport where I was got to watch the Blues arrive. And it is kind of strange watching them arrive, the Delta fly over the international airport and the brakes, and then watch them taxi up. And then I got the privilege to interview Lieutenant Commander David Tickle, who is the lead solo or the number five pilot. I did find out, luckily, that it was his second year, 2013, so he's actually getting a third year, so they get a full team season. So the 2013 team is not changing for 2014. So it's a short interview because it was freezing cold, but I guess we should say take it away. This is David. We're standing out on the freezing flight line at PHL. The Blue Angels just arrived, and I'm here with the number five pilot, lead solo, Dave Tickle. Dave, thanks for being on Airplane Geeks.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So tell me what it's like flying cold in formation.
Well, luckily we have nice heaters in the jet, so we're not flying cold in formation. It's nice and cozy in the cockpit, but you know, in the wintertime the wind's blowing a lot, so the air gets pretty choppy, pretty bumpy. So we're fighting the wind, but you know, we all kind of bump around together, not bump into each other, obviously, but you know, it gets pretty choppy in the wintertime.
Yeah, I'm used to seeing you in 100 degree heat. This is a new for me. So what's it like coming into Philadelphia for this special event, the Army Navy game?
Well, just flying into Philadelphia, first of all, was awesome. Seeing the downtown off in the distance and coming in and being able to bring all the Hornets into this to the international airport, you know, it's pretty cool. You know, normally we'll land at small airfields, a lot less busy, so that's pretty neat. But to be able to come up here and be a part of the Army Navy game is spectacular. I graduated from the Naval Academy, so you know, this game is near and dear to my heart. So to be able to come up here and take part in it is an amazing opportunity. I never thought I'd be here.
And you had a good, we're hoping for a better 2014. How's it feel to be back in the jets after a unfortunate season?
Well, you know, what we do is to go out and represent the armed forces to the American public. So when we didn't get to do that last year, it was very disappointing. But, you know, we've got our funding now for 2014. We've got a full season, and we're looking forward to it. I'm very excited to be a part of it.
So you're part of the 2014 season. So what's going to be your favorite show this upcoming?
Goodness, I don't know. We have a lot of good shows. It's hard to say which one's going to be the best. You know, obviously everybody looks forward to going to Hawaii. That's always a fun trip. It's a long flight out there over the water. Not a whole lot to look at flying from California to Hawaii. But, you know, we get to see so many towns across America that normally you wouldn't get to. I've been to more states than I thought I'd ever be just being on the team here. But we're very fortunate to get to do what we do and pack up our squadron and go to small towns all across the country, because a lot of people in America and a lot of towns in America don't have a Navy or Marine Corps presence, so they're not aware of what their Navy Marine Corps does on a daily basis. So for us to be able to bring the squadron to them and show them the pride and professionalism of our sailors and Marines is incredible.
I'm looking forward to Pensacola this year. I'm going for the first time. My buddy and I have finally said, we're going to do it. But we have a lot of young listeners that want to talk about careers into aviation and stuff. Tell me a little bit about how you went through the Naval Academy, but tell me how you got to fly beautiful blue jets.
Yeah, I selected Naval Aviation from the Naval Academy. We went down to Pensacola to start flight training. I started there in July of 2002, and I finished up, got my wings actually in Meridian, Mississippi, in April of 2005. From there, I went to Naval Air Station Oceana, Virginia, where I learned how to fly the Hornet. Spent about 3 years in VFA 136, the Nighthawks. Did two combat deployments on the USS Enterprise to Iraq and Afghanistan. Spent, like I said, 3 years there. Then I went back to Meridian to be an instructor in flight school. I was teaching students how to land on the aircraft carrier, so that was always challenging. spent about 2 years there, and then I applied for the Blue Angels, and I was very fortunate to get accepted, and I joined the team in September of 2010. I was a narrator my first year, the opposing solo my second year, and then lead solo for 2013 and for 2014.
Good. So you get your full year. That's great.
Oh yeah, I get to finish what I started.
Well, I don't want to keep you because it's freezing cold. But,
that's all right.
Thank you for coming up here, and thank you for taking time. And hopefully, our listeners will appreciate you being on Airplane Geeks.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Are one of y'all over my picture?
All right. Very good, David. That's a nice interview.
Thank you.
Now it's time for Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, we return to the discussion with Osama Sala from the Osama's Talk blog. And on the last segment, we talked about the Dubai Air Show and the effect that the major players in that part of the region had had on airliner production orders. In this segment, we look at some other issues affecting the region and North Africa.
Now, of course, to add to that, we have an exciting development is the Saudi market. We have two airlines that will start sometime next year with Qatar Airways starting using their authority that they obtained in 2012 and starting an airline called Al Maha. And they're looking at airplanes coming from Qatar Airways, but an independent management team.
Right, okay.
Now, this airline, of course, will be domestically at the beginning.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they will have some international routes from Saudi, and I'm sure they will have probably 4 or 5 daily flights to Qatar, to Doha, to feed into Qatar Airways international flights. The other one is Saudi Gulf Airlines, which is supposedly tied up with Gulf Air, even though Gulf Air and the airline are saying the authority is not for Gulf Air, it's for Al Qahtani Corporation in Dammam. Regardless, that is going to be another airline there. So that will start domestically, probably expand to be regionally. And, well, they haven't declared yet what kind of an aircraft they're going to use, but they're kind of saying they'll probably start operating around the third quarter of 2014, with Gulf Air being their technical advisor type of thing. Of course, Dubai, Fly Dubai ordered 100 aircraft, 111 aircraft, 100 737 MAX 8 and 11 737-800s. Now, I'm sure some of that would be a replacement for some of the older 737-8s. And the 11 737-800s probably are an interim until they start getting the MAX into the fleet.
Yeah.
Which, do they have scope for expansion? Definitely. Yeah. Especially after they have become a hybrid airline with a business class. I'm sure they are. And there is a lot of countries that would love, you know, that would love to come to Dubai, which keeps us, which raises the question of what is Air Arabia going to do? Now, Air Arabia is looking for new airplanes, and they're saying they're talking to both Boeing and Airbus. So the chances are they probably order the A320neo.
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to go for a 737 MAX unless Airbus upsets them tremendously. So we'll probably see another maybe 50 or 60 neos coming in. Now, that will also be partly for replacement. I'm sure they will replace older A320s. The ones that without the sharklets, and keep a fleet which is a conventional engine and a new engine offering with sharklets because of performance and these things.
Our call had finished, but I let the recorder keep running. There's so much going on. Amazing, amazing times. It is just phenomenal.
Everybody's expanding, not only these. I mean, by middle of 2000, towards the end of 2014, RJ will get their 787s, and that is partly to get rid of their A340s and their A330s. They've just finished a single aisle renewal by rolling over all their A320 fleet into A319 20 and 21.
Yeah.
I think the oldest one is about 2 years now.
Yeah.
So they're looking at the 787 for their long routes.
Right.
Which should be exciting. Oman Air is having deliveries. Even Gulf Air has a few 787s coming in a couple of years' time.
Yeah.
Now, whether they will take them, nobody knows. But I think the geopolitical situation in MENA is kind of easing off a little bit, especially after the U.S. and Iran got their nuclear deal.
Yeah.
There has been some talk about the Shiites in Bahrain accepting to talk with the government, which they refused to do that. And everybody thinks that this is Iran saying to them, okay, let's do, you know, let's play nice.
Yeah.
So it's, if that happens and Bahrain, for example, stabilizes, that will spell very well. That will be very well, very good for Gulf Air, because Gulf Air's problem is, has always been in the last 2 years, is the political situation, which has not been very conducive to tourism or business.
Yeah.
And now even Iraq ordered a few bombardiers.
Yeah, that's right.
CS-300s.
Yeah.
And so, okay, Iraq is a different, it's like Libya. You know, they have nothing that they're trying to build up.
Sure, yeah.
Even though they have an order of 737-800 MAX and 777s with Boeing, but that is also a big, has big potential. I mean, it's a big country, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
Something like about 18, 20 million people. It's a big country that you can actually have a domestic operation.
Yeah.
And it's an oil producing country. So there is certain wealth in the country. In terms of business, there is a lot of religious tourism for the Shiites there.
Yeah.
And there is actually a potential for tourism if things kind of quieten down a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
So it's hopefully, but you have to remember that in spite of all this going on, the region is still the fastest growing region in the in the world.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
You know, and that's basically because of Qatar Airways, Etihad and Emirates, and you know, the UAE and Qatar probably is what is driving the
It's all the growth, the growth. Engine.
But you look at even RJ, they might not make money this year, but their passenger loads have increased by maybe 2-3%. You know, Oman Air has passengers went up. Middle East Airlines, okay, this is a little bit hinged on Syria more than Jordan is, but you know, it all affected. It's a small region. There's so many problems in such a small patch of land.
Osama, amazing times. What an amazing part of the world for the aerospace industry. Unfortunately, we've run out of time there. But before we go, where can we find out about you online?
Well, I have my blog, which is Osama Steak. And I am on Twitter at OB Salah and on Facebook.
Okay, we'll put links in the show notes to those. But for now, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Well, that's a lot of airplanes, isn't it?
It is. It's amazing. And, I love the livery on that Gulf airplane. Peter sent along a photo that we'll put in the show notes. I think it's kind of a spectacular looking aircraft.
Oh, yeah. I think it's pretty cool.
All right. Well, we have a listener recording. Yeah, you've heard from Launchpad Marzari in the past. He sent in a few recorded reports, and he had an opportunity to interview Raymond Riedman, who's the Red Bull chief pilot and flight operations manager. So we really want to thank Launchpad for sending this in, and we'll let him take it away.
This is Launchpad Marzari with another pilot report, and today we are very fortunate. We are in an incredibly special place with an incredibly special person. We're coming to you from Red Bull Hangar Number 8 in Salzburg, Austria. And real quick, we are in a gorgeous glass hangar, yes, glass, overlooking the Alps. And with me today is Herr Reidman Riedman, the chief pilot for Red Bull Aviation. Sir?
Yes, we are the Flying Bulls, and we are happy to show you a little bit around today. So we have a couple of very, very beautiful airplanes. So now we are sitting in the pilot's office and overseeing our very nice restored Douglas DC-6. The restoration was done about 10 years ago. Took about 80 people alone at Salzburg to do that restoration about 3 years. And after, there came out an airplane fully restored, which is capable of flying everything today. We could fly pressurized, we could fly in clouds, we could do Cat 1 approaches. It's a perfect airplane, but it's just one of for about 40 airplanes which we have in our fleet. And yeah, if you're looking a little bit to the right, you could see a B-38 Lightning and another caravan on floats, which we're able to land in one of the lakes in the surroundings of Salzburg. And here on the other side, you see the Corsair, B-25, and lots of other airplanes like the Alpha Jets.
Yes, several Alpha Jets. And we should note that all of these airplanes are airworthy, correct?
That's correct, and that's a very special thing. So actually, we are a museum, but the museum is able to move over. And of course, especially in summer, basically each weekend we are going somewhere to show our airplanes. We are participating at lots of air shows, at big air shows like in Paris, like in England, the Fighter Collection in Duxford. And so we are going to the, we have been at the Riyadh, the Royal International Air Tattoo, as well as the big air show at Berlin. So basically each year we are going everywhere, and we shouldn't forget about going to Dankosh. Actually, Dankosh is a kind of equivalent as Oshkosh in the United States. It's not that big, but it's big enough, and for Europe it's actually the biggest event.
I know you're very proud of your name, Hangar 7. Why Hangar 7?
That just happened because actually at the airport of Salzburg there already have been 6 hangars, and therefore the next hangar which was built was the Hangar 7. And the Hangar 7 was built on the eastern side and was unique built for the Flying Bulls collection. Thereafter followed the Hangar 8, it was also on our side, and actually it's the maintenance hangar for the Flying Bulls. And the next hangar was Hangar 9, which was built again on the western side. But Hangar 7 and Hangar 8 are two exclusive hangars for the Flying Bulls collection.
What determines the type of aircraft that Red Bull decides to bring into the fleet?
Actually, it's just a mixture of very unique airplanes, so it's not very specific like many collections in the United States, where you just find airplanes from World War II or World War I. So over here, there are airplanes of basically each era of flying, so you could find old airplanes like a Boeing Seaman. You find also World War II airplanes like our B-25 or our B-38 Lightning, the Corsair, the North American T-28, and after we continued with some airplanes from the 50s, like our Douglas DC-6, followed by the Alpha Jets, which are basically a design of the 70s, and we still have very modern airplanes like the Caravan, like the Eurocopters, lots of helicopters. We have the Belkov 105, which are doing aerobatics as well. And we have also quite a couple of very small but legendary airplanes, like the Piper Cup, some training aircraft like the Extra 300, the Sukhoi 29.
Now, like the DC-6 that we see in front of us, that's a working aircraft. You use that as an executive aircraft for moving company officials around.
That's true, yeah. We use it for company people, which we are moving around. It's very rare. It has a very, very nice interior. It has a very nice history. So it was delivered to Yugoslavia and flew as a state airplane for many years for Marshal Tito, moved over to Africa, also flew as a state airplane over there. And finally, it came to us was restored, as I mentioned before, for about 3 years and came out as new, even better than new. And everything working, we could fly IFR, we could fly normal approaches, the pressurization is working. And of course, we are flying our company people in it, but as well, we are taking guests for party, or we are flying with famous actors, or we're going just to air shows to show the airplane. Yeah.
Now, let's talk about you, because I want to emphasize how much everyone's going to hate you out of just pure envy, because you're rated on all of these aircraft, correct?
Not all, but most of them. So I'm not flying the Alpha Jet, but I'm flying the P-38 Lightning, the Corsair, the Douglas DC-6, the P-25 Mitchell, as well as the modern airplanes or executive airplanes like the Falcon 900 and the Cessna 38.
You can stop now. You've impressed us all, and we're all of us airplane geeks are drooling. We want to grow up. You're who we want to be.
It's unique. You're right. Yeah.
Also in the hangar, I've noticed that you've got Felix Baumgartner's capsule.
That's true. Yeah.
The whole
it's here now since a couple of months. Yeah. And has a very, very known history, so we are very happy to house it over here.
For those of you who get a chance to, while you're in Europe, to come, it's not just airplanes, although airplanes are the important part. All their old Formula One cars are here. There's an award-winning restaurant here with huge who's who in chefs. But I'm not a foodie. I'm an airplane geek, so let's get back to talking about airplanes.
That's the same for me, so I'm normally not going there to eat something, so I just come in here to fly over here. So, for me, of course, that's the most important as well.
How many hours average a week, and what's the Red Bull's fleet hours per year estimate?
Basically, I'm flying around 400 to 500 hours a year. Which is quite a lot, because you jump much between very, very different airplanes. And basically, if you're doing air shows, of course, you're doing kind of flying to the air shows. But basically, the air show itself, you're just flying 2, 3, 4 times, about 10 minutes for display. So that's not that much. But of course, I also have to fly, and of course, like to fly with executive airplanes. And there you're getting the hours. And if you count the whole fleet, we have about 2,000 hours on all of our airplanes, which is quite a lot.
Do you ever have to worry about renewing currency on one different type of aircraft or another because you haven't flown it enough because you've been busy?
That's very, very hard, because especially in Europe, you need to do one proficiency check per year. So. Actually, if you have 6, 7, 8 different type ratings, you have to do a lot of proficiency checks, which we are able to do because we have a couple of examiners in our company. I'm an examiner as well. But nevertheless, you shouldn't forget about doing all that stuff, and that's a lot to just which has to stay in your mind that. Next week you have to renew the license for this rating, and maybe 4 weeks later that's the next rating. So, of course, it's a big issue.
Your Red Bull mission is not just advertising. That's more of a side product.
I'm quite sure about that. So, of course, it's nice to see the Red Bull sign painted on the airplanes, and it's also vital for the company. But I think most important is a big joy for our big boss. He's very proud about aviation. He's proud about flying. He's a pilot for himself, so he's flying a couple of our airplanes. And he just likes airplanes, and he likes people who are aircraft nuts, who like just to jump in the airplane and be happy about that. And he likes people who are able to show the airplanes to other people who are impressed by aviation. So he's a real gentleman, and I think that's the point why Flying Bulls is existing. Yeah.
The Flying Bulls are based here in Salzburg. Do you have satellite bases, for instance, in the North American continent or in the Asian continent?
We have one satellite base, which basically is the bulk of 105. That's the helicopter which is able to do aerobatics. And there we have two helicopters, which are basically based, one on the west coast, one on the east coast. But over here, there's just this main base in Europe, because the big advantage on Salzburg is really in the middle of Europe, and so you could go everywhere. And that's our unique base in Europe.
Now, how many other pilots, you just keyed on something, how many other pilots?
So fully employed pilots, I would say we have now 5 fully employed pilots, which is not that much. But you always have to think about the specific airplane itself is not flying that much. We have 40 aircraft. And,
I was going to say, I'm doing math. 40 airplanes, yeah. 5 airplanes. There's 35 slots for those of us who want to be Corsair pilots.
All those people have to jump a lot around. So sitting one day in the Corsair, and the next day flying maybe with the B-25. However, so for the high season of air shows, we have some freelancers which are coming over here. For example, for the Alpha Jets, we have some pilots who normally fly within the Austrian forces, or even one pilot is flying the German force, and he joins at the main season, at the main air show season, the team for the Alpha Jets. So it's sometimes a little bit complicated, but our biggest jump is that everybody would like to fly the aircraft, so they are glad if we call them and say there will be an air show in a couple of weeks. So of course they are trying to get their schedule done so that they could participate with us.
Well, Herr Riedmann, I'd like to, on behalf of the Airplane Geeks, I'd like to thank you for taking this time on a Saturday to come out and show us this magnificent, drool-worthy hangar that's handling all these gorgeous airplanes. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I'm very glad you came over to us to have a look at our really nice collection. And yeah, hope some of the people who are able to hear that conversation are able to participate at one of the Flying Bulls air shows. And yeah, I think we are doing a great show. So we are looking for a new program for next year, so we are doing quite a couple of very tight formation flying with Warbirds, especially the B-38 and the Crosshair, and it should be worth visiting those events. So I hope to see the one or the other formation.
And this has been Launchpad Marzari with an Airplane Geeks Pirate.
All right, thanks for that. You know, he mentioned that there's a lot of glass in these hangars, and he was sitting in the office having that conversation. He said it was hard to concentrate because you could look through all the glass, see all the airplanes, see the Alps back behind that, and just a beautiful setting and quite a facility. So I want to thank Launchpad Marzari for sending that along.
How many airplanes does I didn't think they sold that much Red Bull.
Apparently they do, yeah.
Do they make anything else? Anybody know? Do they make anything else besides the Red Bull energy drink?
I don't think so.
That's pretty much it.
Red Bull's a company now that is more a media company that happens to sell an energy drink than a company that sells an energy drink that uses media to sell its stuff. I mean, look at what they did with the jump from space, their magazines. You know, they have a monthly magazine, you know, just as glossy as anything you'd see here in the States. You look at the events, we've got Red Bull Racing coming back in 2014.
Who's
excited about that?
Yeah. Very good.
Actually, I've gotten to attend one of those, and it's, I don't care how long of a drive it is, go if you have the opportunity, because it's an amazing event. And then just the way it's put together with, let's say, German precision, you know, it's much more Formula One versus, you know, sort of NASCAR, and just the experience of attending a Red Bull event. But, you know, as a company, I mean, the fact that they make fizzy drinks with lots of caffeine that mix well with adult beverages is almost secondary to the fact they're really a media company now.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And they're everywhere. They are absolutely everywhere. All forms of racing and sports and all of that. So yeah, that's great. Sounds like a great destination too to check out this facility.
People mix those fizzy drinks with adult beverages.
Maybe
what
that's
does that
trip,
taste
Rob.
Like?
All right, just really quickly, in a previous episode, we mentioned the video understanding air traffic control that Paul sent in to us, Paul Sherlock. And we got an email from Trevor in Manitoba. I said that wrong as soon as the word came across
wow.
my lips.
That's a David Mangle.
It really is, sorry. But you caught it. Anyway, Trevor says, hi, Airplane Geeks. That Understanding ATC show was on Discovery Canada pre-9/11 and with an American voiceover. Around the same time, there was a show on Discovery Canada called Near Miss that showed ATC in the major New York airports, also pre-9/11. There was also a three-part documentary documenting an Air Canada flight from Toronto to Frankfurt. It was called The Flight. All three were on Discovery Canada in 2000 and 2001 timeframe. He says, I was lucky enough to record all three when they were on TV back then. And he sent along some links to those videos on YouTube. So we'll put those up in the show notes and you can take a look at that. We heard from Tim. Tim says, growing up on Martlesham Heath, where Douglas Bader flew from, was really interesting. Martlesham Heath, is that how you say that? Today is to a large extent a housing estate. However, the control tower still exists and has been renovated into a museum. He says the control tower has flyovers from Spitfires, C-47, and Lancaster on open days. Considering the airfield has been closed for some time, it still has a great aviation following due to its history. Some of the original runway still exists. At one end is the Douglas Bader Pub. The pub itself is built on the runway itself and is a great place to have a beer with lots of pictures of Douglas Bader and World War II airplanes inside. I'm sure David would like it a lot. He says, at one of the Martlesham Heath open days, I was fortunate to meet retired RAF World War II pilot Ken Wallace, who designed and built his own autogyros, or as Grant might say, auto gyros. He's famous for starring in the James Bond film You Only Live Twice, where he piloted his auto gyro pretending to be Bond. I bought one of his books and he signed it for me. This was a few years ago, and at the time I met him, he was 94 years old. He was flying his auto gyro up until he was 96. That's amazing. And still holds many auto gyro records. Sadly, early this year, at 97, he passed away. Maybe I will write an Airplane of the Week article on his auto gyro, as he was a remarkable person and feel privileged to have met him. The East Anglia region of in the UK is just full of aviation history. There are so many old airfields from World War I, World War II, and the Cold War to explore. There are a couple of interesting radar installations in the area. RAF Bodsey is apparently where radar was developed during the war years, and Orford Ness is another radar installation called Cobra Mist, with tall antennas which were pointed towards Russia. The radio waves reflected off the atmosphere and was designed to give an early warning of approaching aircraft. Thanks for mentioning Jeff. It was interesting to learn from his email that he had flown 40 years without an engine failure. I guess it shows how reliable engines are these days. I miss the old A-10s. There used to be a pair of them fly over my bedroom window about 8 a.m. most mornings, the best alarm clock an aviation geek could ever want. They also used to do tight, low turns, maybe only 200 feet or so over the school playing field, which was great. I've done a bit of research with regards to Wethersfield Airfield, and it seems to have a rich history. Many aircraft seem to have been flown from there at one point or another, but I couldn't find any mention about the B-24s. Planes that did fly from there, though, are the A-20J, the F-84 Thunderjet, and F-100 Super Sabres. One interesting point that I read when researching Wethersfield was that the F-84Gs were equipped with small nuclear bombs. He says, scary stuff. I never knew that nuclear arms were in the region back then. I guess at the time I hadn't appreciated the end of the Cold War and why the A-10s were flying around. And then he says, I'm pleased to say that Weathersfield still exists and has not been turned into housing like so many other great airfields in the UK. Gliders are still flown from there for the RAF cadet training, and the three runways remain in good condition. Maybe this is one for the UAV Digest, but I read when researching Air Force Woodbridge that there was a plan to modify some B-17s to be remotely controlled. This was called Operation Aphrodite. The plan being to remotely control the pilotless B-17 into fortified sites, such as the V-2 plants. I wonder if this was the first UAV. So he's put a link in here to the YouTube video of a successful landing at Courchevel Airport in the French Alps. He says this airport approach seemed particularly tricky to me, as there is no go-around option, and if you are too low, you just hit a wall of snow. On top of that, the runway is kind of a ski jump. That's all for now, and that's from Tim in the UK. So I want to thank Tim for sending that along. That's fantastic. And he's got some links that we'll put in the show notes.
Tim, nicely done. Yeah. Having spent 3 and some years of my life at Weathersfield, it brought back a few memories.
Ah, here's one, though.
Well, okay.
What famous person was killed in Operation Aphrodite, causing his brother to run for president?
Really? Wow.
Wait a minute. Was that Kennedy's brother?
Kennedy's older brother was one of the pilots of the B-17 and was fatal was killed in Operation Aphrodite, the B-17 mission, where really they were not really UAVs. They were remote controlled aircraft, but the operation was the pilots were supposed to bail out of it over the channel and have the airplane fly then into the. But yes, John's older brother was fatally killed, and that made his father push John into the presidency.
Interesting. Wow.
Kind of like what they did with that 727 they crashed in the desert a couple of years ago. They got it close and then punched out.
Exactly.
Ah, I see. Okay. All right. Well, we've got a lot more listener mail, but we're kind of out of time, so
we better save it.
We better save it. We will save it. And want to thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guests, especially Rod Rakic and Adam Fast. Gentlemen, thank you so much again for coming on the show, talking to us about Open Airplane. Rod, give us the links where people can go real quick.
Sure. www.openairplane.com on your smartphone, on your tablet, or your desktop computer.
All right. And Adam, thanks again for coming on the show also.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for the invite.
Did we ask Adam where he was dialing in from? Did we ever mention that? Maybe we shouldn't. Maybe he's afraid that
maybe he doesn't want us to
technology
know.
Problems will come to his house and ask if they can fix his PC.
No, I'm in Lawrence, Kansas.
Oh, Lawrence. Wow. No, wait. Isn't that where KU is?
Yeah, it is.
Waka Chaka Raka Waka Chaka thing.
I believe you mean Rock Chalk Jayhawk.
Yeah. Okay. My wife's a Jayhawk. I still haven't been able to get that thing.
However, we do have a street named Wakarusa, which is where I thought you were going with that.
Wow. Chaka Wakarusa. Yeah, okay, whatever.
It's also a river.
Jeez.
We want to thank our contributors, Grant McCarron and Steve Vischer. Find them at PlaneCrazyDownUnder.com. Also, Peter Johnson. You can find his Aviation Extended podcast at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, let's tell people where they can find each of us online. Rob Mark, we will start with you.
Well, they will not find me this year in the pub outside Weathersfield, and I forgot to ask Tim this, if he had ever been to the Fox pub in Finchinfield, which is right near Weathersfield, but I'll save that for, you know, a conversation between the two of us. Happy New Year to everybody. Find us on jetwine.com and Jetwine on Twitter and, I don't know, me on Facebook and I don't know where else. Various and sundry places.
Great. And David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
Well, you can find me on Fridays with you on the UAV Digest. You can find me on Facebook at DM Vanderhoof and on Google Plus as David Vanderhoof and various other sundry places on the internet.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. You can look for me on Google Plus and Twitter as Max Flight. Also, as David mentioned, at the UAVDigest.com for the podcast David and I do. And also at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the Passenger Experience podcast that I'm co-hosting with Mary Kirby. You can find show notes at airplanegeeks.com. You can go straight to the shortcut if you like, airplanegeeks.com/280. This is episode 280. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. And you can also find us on Stitcher.com and TuneIn.com. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Aunt Benet, the aviation queen, will tell you about that.
Please, the Airplane Geeks want to hear from you at 361-GEEKS-01.
Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Thanks for listening. You know how we're going to know that the drone UAV UAS thing has finally been settled? When someday you find out that there's a new show on Broadway called Drones, the Musical. I heard they were trying to sell Cleveland to the Chinese, but I might be wrong.
Are you talking the Browns?
Yeah. What am I saying? The Bears lost last night too to Green Bay, so I'm hardly in a position to talk. There we go. Sorry, I had a large furry creature between me and the mute button here. So,
and also at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the Passenger Experience podcast that I'm co-hosting with Mary Kirby.
There's one I've got to ask you about though, Max. Everybody knows that Mary and I have been, you know, like an item for years. Except maybe Mary, but
don't go there.
How did you get that job? I don't understand that. It just doesn't seem right.
I'm cuter.
And that's it for 2000 and what year is this?
Well, 13.
Today is 13, right. And then within a few days it'll be 14.
I almost learned how to talk like Grant. 2013. 13.
We didn't get to talk about eating kangaroo.
Yeah, I kind of saw that. What do they call it? Kangaroo jerky or something? Or,
well, that's what I was asking about, right? So they're saying that kangaroo actually tastes good and you can buy it in the stores to eat. I mean, they eat this stuff. They really eat this stuff. I figured they were, you know, soft, fuzzy little animals that, you know, you'd never eat.
No, they're livestock like everything else. They're like cattle.
So, yeah, it tastes like chicken.
Yeah, I'm sure. So I started wondering, well, how could we get some kangaroo to try over here in the U.S.? I'm thinking there's no way that you're going to be able to buy kangaroo meat over here in the U.S.
Ah, but they could send jerky, couldn't they?
Jerky. So I thought of jerky. So I Googled kangaroo jerky, and yeah, you can buy kangaroo jerky. So we might have to try that.
Okay. Yeah. And bring that to the Smithsonian this year.
Or to Oshkosh. So they can have Camp Bacon and we can have, you know, Camp Kangaroo or something.